Hey everybody, Filmwax Radio welcomes a new sponsor to the show, Jets Sets, in Long Island City, New York. Jet Sets is a production company that specializes in virtual and augmented reality for pre, live, and post-production. They use state-of-the-art production tools and a render engine to create photorealistic 3D environments for real-time composites. Their system will allow any talent to be placed with any background that you can imagine, both indoor and outdoor, with complete flexibility and freedom. Feel free to contact Jet Sets Studios directly. Go to jetsets.com, JETTSETS.com, for more information. And now on with the show.
This is Griffin Dunn, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, and this is episode 552 of the podcast. It's Thursday, May 9th, 2019. I hope everyone is well. We've been having a great couple of days in New York City. The weather has finally kind of kicked in as far as spring is concerned, and it's much welcomed. You know, nothing says spring like a bunch of festivals, and that's kind of what I've been immersed in. I went to the Montclair Film Festival last weekend, and I had a really great time. I have to say, I caught a number of films, all great. One was particularly gratifying, having grown up in New York City, was a documentary called Other Music, which is about a store, an independent record store that existed in the East Village in New York City, just across the street from Tower Records. I mean, I'm talking about years ago. It actually lived longer because Tower Records closed, 15 years ago. I'm just guessing. But Other lived a bunch of years longer and closed down a few years back. And fortunately, these two filmmakers, Rob Hatch Miller and Paloma Basu, who I was lucky enough just to meet in New Jersey the other day, made this great documentary. It's really wonderful. And it's actually also going to be at the Maryland Film Festival this coming weekend. I'm going down to Baltimore on Friday to catch that festival, and I'm going to talk to those guys about their documentary. And that was just one. I also caught up with this new film. It's called Skin, with Jamie Bell, the actor Jamie Bell, and co-starring former Filmwax Radio guest Danielle McDonald. It's directed by, I believe he's an Israeli filmmaker named Guy Nativ. I may have mispronounced his name, and I assume he's Israeli, but I could be wrong. It's about a young guy who is a skinhead and a Nazi, and he has a sort of this existential internal dilemma going on, and wants to leave, but it's incredibly, of course, difficult to do so. Anyway, that was a pretty amazing film to see. And saw lots of other stuff. So, and I'm going to hopefully repeat this exact same thing in a couple of days at the Maryland Film Festival. So I should mention also, if you're a filmmaker and you're listening, I'm always talking about some of these festivals I go to regularly. I go to the Hamptons and Woodstock because I like going to those towns. And the festivals both usually have enough films that I have a great time. And now I go every year to Montclair and every year to Maryland Film Festivals because I have friends and family and always have a good time, or it's close enough to New York to make it happen and make it effortless. And so another one that it looks like I'm going to be adding to that list of film festivals is the Lighthouse International Film Festival. And actually their opening night film, they just announced, is Skin. So I am on the jury for this festival, but I went last year and had a fantastic time, and I was glad to forge some relationships with that festival. So Filmwax will be there, and that's in June, and go check it out, Lighthouse International Film Festival. If you are anywhere near New Jersey, in that part of the Jersey Shore, I really recommend you check out the festival. Long Beach Island is just such a lovely spot, and I was glad to finally get there. And now I would love to make it a regular part of my festival routine. Anyhow, I just thought I'd mention that. Welcome to episode 552 of the podcast. Oh boy, was this a fun episode. Two actors. We have one who has been a regular on the show. He is back for his third visit. His name is Paul Lazar. Right when I started this podcast, before it was a podcast, it was an internet radio show. And I did it out of a studio in Brooklyn for Bebox Radio. It still exists. You can check them out. And I was reading the New York Times about this actor named Paul Lazar. I already knew his work. I knew who he was. So when I read the article, I was like, oh boy, he's in Brooklyn. He's nearby. I'm just going to see if he's on Facebook. And of course he was. And then the next thing you know is, you know, I'm writing him, and he gets back. He says, sure, I'll do your show. And that was episode 23 of the show, Film Wax Radio. And would you believe it? He had such a good time that he ended up getting his own show on Bebox. Conversations with Paulie, I think that's what it was called. And he did that for a little while, and then that too kind of dropped out. He's so engaged and so busy. He is not only an actor, a terrific actor, but he's also has a dance and theater company with his wife that he out of Brooklyn, and they're always performing all around the world. So Paul is, and he's just a sweetheart. I really like him personally. We always have a great time when we talk. So he's back for his third time on the show, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. But first up here, oh my goodness, how did this happen? For years, people have been telling me that I look like the actor Kenneth Branagh. It's not just once or twice, I'm talking about dozens of times. Strangers, people I know, even recently an ex-girlfriend was watching Wallander on Netflix, which is Branagh's detective series. And it's worth watching, by the way. I guess I saw it to some degree, but you know, whatever, you know, people say this, they've said it about other people about me, but it was so many times. So, out of nowhere, I was offered the opportunity to sit with Kenneth Branagh and have a talk about his new movie. It's called All Is True, and they sent me the movie, and I watched it. I mentioned on the last episode now I have a projector at home, and I have a great sound system. And so, you know, I was able to watch it. And I have to tell you, I really enjoyed this movie. It is not cutesy. It's not hokey. It's not silly. This is a really psychologically deep story with really meaningful performances, stars Kenneth Branagh. It also has Judi Dench and Ian McKellen in it, and a bunch of other fine actors. And again, it's called All Is True. It's opening up tomorrow, Friday, here in New York and in LA. But if you're not living, if you live in between the coasts or somewhere else, or if you live near a major city, it's probably going to get to you in the coming weeks. But of course, it'll eventually be available in streaming and other formats. And I really do recommend it. I was surprised, pleasantly so, I might add, by just how much I enjoy the film. So, and it's about Kenneth Branagh, who's been producing and directing and acting in Shakespearean productions, whether on film or on stage, for, you know, something like 30 years now, maybe more. He's also president of the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England. He has got so much Shakespearean experience under his belt. So, you know, this seemed like a natural thing that eventually he would play William Shakespeare, and it's a terrific film. It really is entertaining. It is not a comedy, I can tell you that, but it's also not a stodgy, stuffy type of production either. It's in some ways relatively modern feeling, but it is not some sort of dated, anachronistic type of thing. You just have to kind of see it. Go look at the trailer. We're going to play a little bit of it in a second as we go into this. But this was, of all the hundreds and hundreds of interviews I've done, and maybe even 1,000 interviews I've done over the years, this is one of my favorites. I'm not saying that. All I can say is, you know, you walk into a room and you meet somebody new you've never met before, and you just don't have any idea until you sit down how it's going to go. You can be as prepared as you could possibly be, or just be in a great mood, or what have you. But once in a while, things just click, things just take. And this conversation with the actor and the director, Kenneth Branagh, is one great example of just that. We were on our game. We had a connection. It was fantastic. He thought I was, pretty good. I don't know. He had a good time. I could see it. He was smiling and laughing almost the entire time. I shared with him everything I just shared with you. And we had a good time. We sat for only a short time. It was 25 minutes at the most, I think. And I wish it were twice that long. It could easily have gone on much longer. Unfortunately, this time we didn't have the time, but who knows? So let's go into that conversation now, okay? This is Kenneth Branagh, first time on the podcast. The name of the movie, again, is All Is True. He plays William Shakespeare, who has returned from his incredibly illustrious career in London as the premier playwright bard of the stage, the Globe Theatre. His own theatre that he built has burned to the ground after a terrible, terrible accident. And he returns to the family home in Stratford-on-Avon, where he grew up and where he still resides, to some complicated, unresolved personal matters. Let's put it that way. Here it is, my conversation with Kenneth Branagh, here on Filmwax Radio.
There is no corner of this world you have not explored. No geography of the soul which you cannot navigate.
Mr. Shakespeare, I don't want to pester you.
Good. Excellent news. Cheerio.
I just wanted to ask you...
The best way to get started as a writer is to start writing.
No, really, could I just...
I don't have a favourite play. I admire all my fellow dramatists equally, and yes, I do think women should be allowed to perform the female roles, as is the practice on the continent now. Please, if you'll excuse me.
Father?
Why are you coming? No more stories left to write.
I've lived so long in imaginary worlds, I think I've lost sight of what is real.
Will, it's Sunday! You miss church here, they'll find you.
Your talent has a greater scope than all the other poets. And yet you lived the smallest life.
Family is everything.
It's love, not ambition, that will blossom in this garden.
Well, something has to.
1, 2, 3,
beautiful.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
That is the mellifluous tones of Sir Kenneth Branagh. Do you know how many people have... I'm not kidding. Do you know... Are you looking in the mirror? Do you know how many people I have had to... I've never even seen your new movie. I've never seen any of your movies. But so many people have come up to me and says, do you know who you look like? And I'm like, Kenneth Branagh, I know. It has happened so many times.
I hope you're not insulted. I was just admiring your hair there. I think you've got a fine head of hair.
You too.
And I've been lucky with that in my life. But so maybe, you know, with that, so
yes.
We share that.
And now that I look at you, yeah, I guess they're right. The last one was my ex-girlfriend. And she sent me a message. She goes, I'm watching Wallander. I would say Wallander, but then it's about.
And I say Wallander.
Let's call that off. But anyway, yeah. So, and then I said, okay, I've been watching seriously since your first probably feature film here, Dead Again. But I turned it on, and then of course I got sucked into it, that show.
Oh, okay.
And before we talk about this new role, which is you played the bard in All Is True, which makes so much sense given your career. That you.
Well, it's
you're playing that role.
It got to this point of almost it being a kind of handshake back across the ages. I hitchhiked to Stratford-upon-Avon when I was 17 years old with a tent that I'd bought from my mother's catalogue, paid 99 pence a week for 20 weeks. I was thrilled to have. And going to see Shakespeare, this pilgrimage was like the beginning of my life as an independent adult. And here I am, I'll be 60 next year. Mm-hmm. And and actually, instead of just going to visit where he lived, I started acting where he lived and being the man himself. And mm-hmm. so it has it's some curious bit of symmetry has gone on.
Okay, but you're the what is the title? Your title with the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, right?
You have, I am the president of the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. Yeah,
correct. And you have up to date between theater and films. How many productions would you say that you of Shakespeare would you say that you have launched?
I'm told it's about 25. So that's not doing too badly, I think.
No. Yeah. So now and then, were there other opportunities to play William Shakespeare in the past, or maybe you already have?
No, I haven't okay. before. But there were actually no, I did on a few skits on TV shows, yes, occasionally there was, but most Shakespeare's on screen have been of the rompy variety, you know, very much spectacularly in Shakespeare in Love, you know, where it's such a, you know, fantastically mm-hmm. frothy imagined idea of a certain take on his life. But it wasn't until I thought about, you know, what happened when he decided to go back to Stratford at the end of his creative career. And we didn't really know much about that. And when Ben Elton, who wrote the screenplay for this film, got involved, we both said, look, we need to look at what's in the public record office here. What do we know about him? And we found out more than you might imagine that it seems to be accurate about the man from Stratford.
I'm in my mid-50s, and I thought I had known pretty much everything there was to know about his life. Yet I had to go back and look after all of a sudden, wait a minute, he had a son that died very young, mm-hmm. was of one of twins, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. were in the other surviving twin. How much of the story, that's Hamnet, who died of, we'll say, the plague, for the sake of the film and the telling the story, and how much of that part of it, his death, and how much of the rest of the family dynamics, which the film explores, it's lovely, is from the record that you just mentioned.
Well,
and how much
on,
did you fill in?
Based on fact, but then it expanded into fiction via the plays themselves.
Okay.
The last three or four plays of Shakespeare's were obsessed with father-daughter relationships.
Tempest.
Yes, yeah, very much. And he starts to use magic in his last plays. He didn't
That's
before.
Right.
He was always a psychological realist with the occasional ghost, but he really goes for fairy tales in those last four plays, as if somehow he wants life to have a happy ending. Because I think he had already established that on the whole it doesn't. It's bittersweet, and when a child is lost, a child is lost. It doesn't come back. Statues don't come back to life and tell you everything's going to be all right. The idea of him returning to Stratford to face real facts, like both daughters were involved in sexual scandals. That's in the public record. A man called John Lane did stand up in 1614 in Holy Trinity Church and say, Susanna Shakespeare is a whore and she's got gonorrhea, all publicly
gonorrhea?
Documented. Gonorrhea?
Oh, well, that's entirely different.
Yes, exactly. But that may have been an inspiration for another play. And also, and the younger daughter also involved in a sexual scandal, which ended up in public in the church in its resolution. He did go searching for a coat of arms so that he could be called gentleman. He paid £20 for it, about $5,000 a day. And those are the kinds of things that helped us fill in what would have been the sort of disturbance in him, as he tries to come to terms with not exactly creating mm-hmm. a fairy tale in his own life, but trying to come to peace with the impact of the loss of that kid on the rest of his family, a family who could not write or read. Mm-hmm. There they were involved with the most famous writer of the age. There were many things to settle, and so
right.
it became quite a fertile ground for drama.
Well, you set up, it's interesting because I want to just explore some of this that you just talked about, because on one hand the film starts with the tragedy of the fire which destroyed the Globe Theater,
yeah.
which is his theater in London.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And that seemed to be the catalyst, but maybe it was not a catalyst. Perhaps it was more of an excuse for him. Maybe these things that you're describing. And the plays that he was writing towards the end back that up, that things were starting to haunt him.
Yeah.
Unfinished business was in, you know, just was disturbing him, and he needed to find peace with some of the stuff, and that maybe was why he went back home. Maybe not the fire in of itself.
Although it's a traumatic event that was symbolic of 20 years in which that theater had ruled London's sort of creative life. All of his plays and many of the plays of his friends, contemporaries and rivals had been done. And I think it's true, it's a really good word for what happens in the story. He is haunted, literally haunted, by his dead son, but also by a sort of, an inability to sort of fix where his life is. He has to resolve a sort of romantic challenge in his life. He's married to a woman who he has not seen so much for these 20 years, but he's also visited by someone for whom there may have been unrequited love in the form of the Earl of Southampton.
Right, played by some actor named Ian something or other. I'm not familiar with him, but
Ian McKellen. I don't know if he works much, but I haven't seen much that he's done. But he, you know, he's the only one we could get for this one. So
I get it. Well, it's nice that you threw him a bone.
Yeah,
you're a nice guy.
He appreciated that. We actually, Ian McKellen shared with me that he had he'd also hitchhiked to Stratford when he was 17, and we pitched our tents in the same field 25 years apart. Yeah, like Judy Dench is a sort of Shakespearean master, and he there are few people who you would be more intimidated if you're playing Shakespeare and you're going to perform one of the sonnets that Shakespeare wrote, and the next bit of the action is that the other actor performs that sonnet and bats it back at you like a kind of fancy tennis match, literary tennis match. But I couldn't have been more honored, I must say, that he would do it, and in so doing, let this would-be lover down gently. If Shakespeare was suffering from unrequited love, Southampton manages to say in the saying, the very different saying of that same sonnet, I love you and your work, but not in that way. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a very sort of poignant moment. And in terms of a professional experience to do that scene with him in this film, I'd never worked with Ian McKellen before, was really an enormous excitement and a privilege. I don't think I've prepared so much for a scene in many a long year. I did not want to let him down.
So there's this exploring this relationship with the Earl of Southampton, and there is the relationships with the daughters. And it's interesting. I mentioned Wallander at the beginning, and I was reminded of some wonderful scenes that you had with David Warner, the actor David Warner, mm-hmm. also were
great Shakespearean actor.
Yes, and the character, your character in that, just so happens to be also dealing with similar themes. Which makes the movie, in terms of his relationship with his daughter, the detective, the cop mm-hmm. that you play, and his father, and you know the psychological family drama that plays out through that series. And this, likewise, also explores some of those similar themes. I mean, it is just a psychological family drama in the end. Mm-hmm, this, you know, so we can relate to Shakespeare, Shakespeare.
For me, this is the central connective thread in his work. He makes us laugh, makes us cry. Mm-hmm. He has this great body of work, and he's come up with many purple patches, so there are many greatest hits, as it were. But regularly, what surprises mm-hmm. me... Mm-hmm. is the way in which his understanding of basic human dynamics, particularly in families, are common to so many of us. And in All Is True, you know, much of the tension and the conflict is born out of not only the sort of immediate fact of what happens in any particular scene, but is usually scratching at the surface of something that goes much deeper. And we all know in our own lives, you know, that there can be, you know, the argument at the kitchen table about the spilt tea or coffee or whatever is rarely about that very thing. Sure. It's usually about the spilt coffee from 15 years ago when you didn't say sorry or understand. And that can go nuclear very, very quickly, to everyone's surprise. And of course, you know, human beings, even in the most modest circumstances, I don't know an ordinary human being. They're all extraordinary and all capable of passion and fire that really astonish one. So Shakespeare knew that, plugged into it, and held the mirror up to let us see it so regularly. So why should that not exist in his own family?
Mm. The film, it's as you said, is already is called All Is True, which was the name, the original name for which play was it?
Henry VIII. The play that was premiered on June 29th, 1613, and at the end of Act One, Scene Four in All Is True, or The Life of Henry VIII. A play partly about the pageantry of that time. A cannon was fired and shot from that same cannon, erroneously landed on the thatched roof of the Globe, where it caught fire. And a few hours later, the entire building was burned to the ground, and 3,500 people escaped with their lives.
No one was killed.
No one was killed, to the astonishment of all, but with the exception of one man widely reported to have burnt his bottom on the way out, which was a source of fun for those, for everybody except the man with the burning bottom.
Yes.
But he was the only casualty of that day.
One can't frame the destruction of the Globe Theater, which, you know, is remarkable in our history, theater history, but wonder what would have happened if it didn't burn down and Shakespeare had stayed in London and didn't return home. Certainly the story wouldn't have been... But what's the screenwriter?
His name Ben Elton.
Ben Elton wouldn't have probably written this story. I wonder how much of this William Shakespeare, the father, the husband, would have, you know, if he would have had the opportunity to live out the last years in Stratton.
I have the sense, I mean, it's a good question, but I have the sense that what you talked about earlier, the idea of a man haunted by, you know, the idea of needing closure about the death of a son, simply because the infant mortality rate was higher, then I think the loss of a child is no less of a scar on a family or a person than it would be in a time when that was a more rare occurrence. I think he needed to get back there, and there's a necessity, there's a longing, there's an ache, there's a desire, there's a melancholy and a search for some sort of order, closure, reconciliation, peace in the last plays that he writes that would make me think that he needed to be back home. He needed to go home.
Yeah.
And this is also, frankly, it's what many of his plays are about as well. You know, people go on these voyages. In the last plays, there are metaphors for those Odyssean voyages across the Mediterranean for Pericles and his daughter, or for the imprisoned Prospero in the tempest, the lost baby on the coast of Bohemia in The Winter's Tale. People go on these journeys, but their ultimate destination is to come peacefully to home.
What a great way to wind it down, but I still have 5 minutes, so screw that. I want to talk to you. I'm so grateful to the publicist who brought the film to my attention as well, I wonder if I would have seen it otherwise, because I first thought, oh, this is going to be, you know, this another attempt to bring an historical figure or a culturally historical figure to, you know, some sort of modern way. And actually, you didn't at all, it seems, I have to say. And I really felt you went deep with this film. I mean, first of all, the character definitely goes deeper and deeper. You know, like you mentioned Odysseus and also Dante, Inferno, like kind of going through the seven
circles of hell.
Circles of hell in a way, and until he gets finally to, well, maybe it's a bad analogy because he actually finds peace at the end, but has to go
through trials.
There is a lot of suffering.
It's through trials and tribulations, but it's not an experience unknown to people. We you know, change is the most difficult thing for most human beings to deal with. We often resist it. It's hard to embrace it. We mostly have to endure it. And he does so, and in that sense, I think he's immensely brave. He offers a simple example of ordinary human courage, which is, as someone once explained to me about the definition of what makes a good marriage or how is it sustained, and the answer was, you've got to stay in the room. Well, Shakespeare stays in the room. He stays in the room, and he toughs it out when people
confront him with some very painful truths.
Yeah, you weren't here. We needed you. You weren't here.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what you say now, what you do now, because that ain't ever going away. That's a fact. And
you can't unring that bell or whatever the expression is.
And I think that is what's so powerful about the last plays of Shakespeare, and we try to bring it into this film, is just that implacable, irrevocable loss when things of such sort of catastrophic, personal, you know, and painful moment happen in a life and they cannot be changed. All that can be changed is your attitude to that thing. But that ain't an easy shift. And in this case, it needs a whole family to sort of, in an ad hoc way, stage a kind of intervention that allows Shakespeare to see his life in a different way.
Yeah, those moments do seem almost like an intervention, you know. And he toughs it out, you know, the characters.
He does tough it out.
Yeah. Again, the name of the film is All Is True. It's directed and stars Sir Kenneth Branagh. And it opens in New York and L.A. on Friday, the 10th of May. It had a brief run, I know, in Los Angeles for consideration, all that stuff. But it's going to be finally more broadly available. And I have a feeling it's going to go national.
Yes,
over the coming weeks.
The plan is definitely to roll it out there. If the good people of this country are interested to see it, we'll be bringing it to them.
Now, I have a favor. Okay, this is the name of the this podcast I do, which I talk to many creative people in the film world like yourself, and just spoke to Mike Lee a few weeks ago, and I also talk to a lot of emerging, unknown people, but kind of mix it. Anyway, but when I get someone like yourself in the room, who I've been watching for years, I ask them if they would say something along the lines of, you're listening to blah, blah. Do you mind doing
that? No, I don't mind doing that.
Are you sure?
Yes,
okay.
I
don't. So the name is Film Wax Radio. Film Wax Radio.
Film Wax Radio. So.
Yeah. So you just say anything you want.
Okay.
I don't.
So you are listening to the extraordinary sounds, density, and brilliance of Film Wax Radio.
You have to say your name, though. That's the problem. Nobody's going to know it was you.
That would be a nice mystery tease.
Sorry. That was so... I'm sorry.
No worries. Hello, my name's Kenneth Branagh, and you are listening to the extraordinary Film Wax Radio.
I think you should say, this is Sir Kenneth Branagh.
No, I'm not going to say
Sir
that.
Sir Kenneth Branagh. And you're a fan of what team? What's your team?
It's Tottenham.
Still.
Tottenham Hotspur, of course. There's only one team for a lifetime.
Right. Thank you so much for that, for everything. It was great to meet you and to talk to you. And I'm going to encourage everybody to go out and see All Is True.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My husband thinks you've come home to die.
I've just bought a pension. I can't die for at least 10 years or I'll be ruined.
You went to London and became this great writer. With a wife at home, you were hardly here.
To us, you're a guest. Good night, husband.
Retirement hasn't exactly brought the peace we might have hoped for.
You must write again, Will. People need you.
My soul was empty.
Your soul is not empty, Father. Your soul has the whole world in it.
Why? Why did you stop writing?
I've never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
All these years worried about your reputation. Have you even once considered mine?
Through my genius, I've brought fame and fortune to this house. I'm the head of this family.
If you're honest with yourself, then whatever you write, all is true.
Paul Azar has been on episodes 23, 370, and now this episode, 552. Again, I met him. There are certain actors and folks that I just, you know, and I'm always thinking, I would like to talk to them and get to, I don't know what it is. It's something offbeat usually, just something unique about the way they act or look or a combination of that. You know what I'm talking about. So I contacted him. It was very, very straight. It was easy, and it all worked out so smoothly. And this has got to be about 6-7 years ago. He was on episode 23, after all. And I was, I was doing the show for maybe a few, 4, 5, 6 months or something up to that point. We've sustained a friendship. I'm very proud of it. His company, theater dance company, is called big dance, and they perform all over the world. He has a new production that he's doing in various places called Cage Shuffle, which he's going to talk about at length, and even perform a bit of it, so to speak, at least the oral part of it. And we catch up. Paul is a terrific guy. You know him. He's got relationships with a few filmmakers. He did a number of Jonathan Demme films until, of course, Jonathan Demme died 2 years ago. He also, interestingly enough, has a similar relationship with Bong Joon-ho, having taken supporting roles in Snowpiercer and The Host, I think. And he's done a bunch of indie films as well. This is a friend of the Filmwax Radio and mine. Here is Paul Lazar back for his third visit on Filmwax Radio.
What I wanted to tell you about that's new and exciting is a solo piece that I created and is toured now in Berlin and Cologne and Chicago, Austin, Seattle, other places. That's just off the top of my head. Anyway, it's a solo performance called Cage Shuffle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took a peek at the website.
Oh, you did? Okay, because the website even, www.cageshuffle.com.
I don't think you have to say www anymore.
Only me, who's 500 years old. So, Cave Shuffle.
Cave Shuffle.
Yeah.
So it's a solo dance thing. So,
well, what it is...
Or movement.
Cage wrote... created a piece in the...
John Cage,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The composer, philosopher, visual artist, hugely influential figure and art makers of the latter part of the 20th century.
Yeah, no doubt.
Huge. Mm-hmm. So John Cage, one of his millions and millions of projects was a piece called Indeterminacy, which he created in the late 50s. And one part of it is that he wrote 90 stories. And he recorded them. And when he recorded the stories, and I'll give you an example of a few, the form that he put them in was every story is exactly 1 minute long. So if it was a more lengthy, elaborate story, he had to talk lightning fast to make it record in exactly a minute. Or a smaller story, he would put spaces in it so that it always timed out every story exactly a minute
long. Wow.
Okay, so what I've done is taken about 30 of my favorites of the 90 stories. They're very, well, read a few, speak a few of them on the air so we can get a sense of it. But they're very funny and they're very insightful and they're very tricky in a good sense of sometimes seemingly simple but have very resonant meaning to them. So I took about, let's say, 25 to 30 of those and I put them on a playlist on my iPhone. And so what I do when I do the performance is I have an earbud so that I'm listening to my iPhone and I hit shuffle. And so the stories come up in random order. I put like a 10-second pause between each one. They come up in random order. I don't know which one is coming. Whichever one comes up, it'll go in my ear just like when you listen to your iPhone. But I will speak it as I hear it. So I will be speaking these stories.
They're not memorized.
They're not memorized. I hear them and speak them as I hear them. As I'm speaking them in their random order, I'm doing a dance at the same time. The dance, though, is not random. The dance moves are a fixed sequence of movements. So that the way the stories and the words, where they hit up against the movement, is different every time I perform it.
Mm-hmm.
because I'm saying different stories in a different order and doing the same dance. The whole thing's about a half an hour. So it's a kind of a really, it took me about a year to master it where I could speak these words, and sometimes lightning fast.
Because like I was going to just say, you said some of them were super fast.
So
that's amazing.
So on the radio, you can't see the dance, although you can see the whole thing I'm describing, because all you got to do is go to cageshuffle.com. And on the part of the website that says video is a video of an entire performance, which is not long. The whole piece is about 40 to 50 minutes long, that I did at Harvard University last March. And I made a decent video of that one. Mm-hmm. And so that's the one I have on my site, on my website.
And when you put these readings on Shuffle,
yeah,
there's no chance that it's going to repeat, though, during one of the performances, is there?
No. Because it's on Shuffle, I have enough of them so that I will complete the dance before we've gone back and started repeating any. Because, you know, with Shuffle, it won't repeat till it's played all of...
Oh, I wasn't sure.
All of them. Yeah.
Sometimes if you put on Shuffle, it might repeat something.
Right. No, at least in my experience, it doesn't start repeating till it's played all of them once.
That makes sense.
And so I haven't had any repeats yet.
Mm-hmm.
So just for the fun of it, I'm going to do what I do in my dance, which is I will find the playlist and then I'm going to hit Shuffle. And this is sort of seeing, this is the half of the piece that you can do on the radio. I'll hit Shuffle. I'll just do a couple of them.
Can always record, videotape something.
Oh, okay. If you want
to
see it.
It might be kind of cool to do a little segment like that. I actually,
oh, yeah. Here we go. So should I hit Shuffle and I'll do two or three? Then, if you want me to do the dance as well.
Well, no, you don't have to do that. I mean, it's up to you. That's up to you.
That's optional? Okay. Well, here are a few of the stories. Let's start with that. Oh, here's a fast one's coming up.
Good.
I just saw that. It's a good practice for me. I once had a job washing dishes in the Bluebird Tea Room in Carmel, California. I worked 12 hours a day in the kitchen. I washed all the dishes, pots and pans, scrubbed the floor, washed the vegetables, crates of spinach, for instance. If the owner came along and found me resting, she sent me out in the backyard to chop up some wood. She paid me $1 a day. One day I noticed that some famous concert pianist was coming to town to give a recital. I decided to finish my work as quickly as possible in order to get to the concert without missing too much of it. I did this. As luck would have it, my seat was next to that of the lady who owned the Bluebird Tea Room, my employer. I said, "Good evening." She looked the other way, whispered to her daughter. They both got up and left the hall. It was a fast one.
That was great. But that was only a minute. Was that a minute?
That was exactly a minute.
That was?
They're all exactly
a
minute.
Yeah, you said that, but that seemed like a half a minute or something.
Well, you can look. You can type it. 4 years ago, I was talking to Hidegazu Yoshida. We were on the train from Donaueschingen to Köln. I mentioned the book by Harrigal called Zen and the Art of Archery. The melodramatic climax of this book concerns an archer hitting the bullseye, though he did so in total darkness. Yoshida told me there's one thing the author failed to point out. That is, there lives in Japan at the present time a highly esteemed archer who's never yet been able to hit the bullseye, even in broad daylight. And they go on like that. I don't know if you want to hear any more, but that's the idea. They're all pretty amusing and interesting,
must be a lot easier to, or does it get harder again just to read it without doing the dance moves?
It's easier to, you know, once I can do it and dance at the same time. Doing it without dancing is sort of like, piece of cake.
Sure. Yeah.
Although I have to do all of it often. So that I don't
lose it.
Forget it. Mm. Lose it.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense.
My the sort of latter the the second part of the piece, which is shorter than the first part where I tell the 25 stories, I put on a composition by Cage. I have a record player on stage, and I put on a record, a little portable record player.
Oh, yeah.
And I put on a record of the John Cage composition called Dream. I have a portable record player on stage. And then what I do is I go back and start at the top of the dance again and dance through a portion of it a second time through to the Cage music. And a couple reasons why I like to do that is, one is you're seeing the same dance again, but to music instead of me saying stories. And it looks like a completely different dance. So it's kind of beautiful to see how different movement looks when there's a different oral experience going on.
Right.
Suddenly it's the movement has, Dream is quite a beautiful piece. And so it has sort of emotional import that the dance didn't have prior to having this underscoring of music. But this coming March 8th and 9th, I'm going to be doing the piece at Princeton University and the fabulous contemporary composer David Lang is going to, with a small ensemble group, is going to play the Cage music live. So it'll, instead of me doing it on my record player,
it takes on all new.
Yeah, level. Which I am very excited. I don't know what that'll be about.
Well, you will soon.
Yes,
it's only 6 weeks away or something.
Yes.
That's great. You and your partner, your wife,
yes.
Annie B. Parson, you guys have been running a dance company for a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's sort of a hybrid of theater and dance.
Okay.
We've kind of existed in theater and dance venues for 26 years.
Gee
big
whiz.
Dance theater. Yeah, started out, well, in the New York area, Dance Theater Workshop was our dance venue often, and theater venue often was Classic Stage Company at
time. On 13th Street?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then eventually as dance and theater became more recognizable and less of a rarity, we found our way to venues that exist on that same cusp or that comfortably present dance theater and dance theater. Like The Kitchen, like BAM. Been to BAM a bunch of times. And like Abrams Art Center, various New York venues, as well as doing a lot of touring.
Right.
But
campus, is that just a typical? Is that like a place where they're receptive and where you're often invited?
You mean the university
setting? Campus?
You know, this piece, this solo piece, Cage Shuffle, has had a lot of touring, and I would say it sort of divides about 50-50 between performance venues
and the universities.
And the university setting. Because, you know, knowing about Cage, it has a whole, I'm very hesitant to say academic component, but certainly universities have a real interest in turning students on to Cage from many angles. And so it's appealing in a university context. I would
say it seems
like
you could just be a bard all year round.
Yeah.
with the kind of show you're doing.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I actually am going to be at Bard this summer with a different piece of work. A guy who also performs at BAM, a great physical theater maker named Jeff Sobel, and a great actor and magician named Steve Schiffo, and a great actor and everything maker named Trey Lyford. The three of us made a piece for St. Anne's Warehouse Theater called Elephant Room, mm-hmm. a sort of hilarious, comedic piece mm-hmm. about three magicians. And we're making a new piece also for St. Anne's Warehouse Theater. And it's going to be rehearsing at Bard this summer.
Oh, wow.
And actually, I think it will premiere at Bard in early September. Then it'll go to the Philly Fringe Festival. So keep an eye out for it.
Sure,
I would love to say the name of it, but the name is sort of in the works.
Understood. So. Understood. Can you talk about just process a little bit, Paul, about just how this current piece that you're excited about? I was going to say, make a joke myself, is that the John Cage aspect of your show, the Cage part of your title, is attractive to the university, but I would imagine the Shuffle is it demographically to the kids, because you know they're listening to, well, I don't even know if they're listening to iPods or what, or
yeah,
or
right,
iPhones.
They may have,
they're listening to music on their iPhones,
right, they may have maybe transcended the iPhone completely. Now there's probably some device
yeah.
which exists. Speaking of jokes, the thing when I do my spiel, mm-hmm. when I, because I do it, the way I explained what I do in the piece, that I tell these stories that are on Shuffle and dance at the same time, I actually explain that at the beginning of the performance, because people see you telling the stories and they see you moving, but it's fun for them to know that you don't know what story is coming next.
Right.
And sure. this particular movement going with this particular story is a complete act of chance.
Right. I mean, people really dug when Elvis Costello, remember all those years back when
yes.
Elvis, sure, but that's come up, right? Elvis
right.
Costello, the roulette wheel
yes.
With all the songs.
Yes.
And he would spin it and
yes.
whatever. It, I mean, that's, you know, that was a brilliant idea.
Yes.
I think he just went back and did it recently again.
Yeah.
For the first time since
yeah.
the 80s or whenever he did that.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So
now
all
he's
got to
reel,
do
though.
Is do a dance, an elaborate dance at the same time, and then Elvis Costello will have ascended to my level.
That's right.
Which would be quite thrilling for him, I think.
I should think so. He hasn't done it. He's. How do you conceive of this piece? Like, how does it get from nothing into where it's at?
Well, it's a really good question, and I don't entirely remember how this business got started of creating this piece this way. But mm-hmm. there's certain things that I do know, which are that, you know, there's a sort of seminal avant-garde theater company whose influence on, I would say, American, even mainstream culture, as well as certainly the downtown theater culture, is huge.
Right.
This company was called the Wooster Group.
Sure.
And one of the things, of the many innovative things that that company did, was they started to put a earphone into your ear, into the performer's ear. I've performed with them periodically. Put an earphone into your ear, sort of like if you're listening to your phone.
Isn't that wireless, though?
Yeah, they mm-hmm. did it wirelessly, mm-hmm. actually, yes, and would feed their actors the lines that way, because sometimes the director preferred the words coming out in a way that was more in a constructively discombobulating to the performer.
Mm.
That just the language would come at them and they say it right away before they would that would short circuit, perhaps the intent was to short circuit the sort of actorly side of a performer.
Cerebral
who
side
to,
of it. Or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah, the actorly way, I guess. Yeah, you're right.
You know, who maybe wanted to do it a certain way or, mm-hmm. or put this or that interpretation upon it, sometimes for reasons that had to do with the grand scheme of a piece. The director would want the words to just come into the actor's head just like in a stream like that. Anyway, it's a long way of saying the what's called the in-ear device became a very, very useful tool for our company and for many, many companies to be used in a variety of ways,
mm-hmm.
not always as excitingly or innovatively as the Wooster Group did it, but the thing of feeding actors their lines in their ear had all kinds of positive and useful uses. So I our company used that technique regularly. So
BDT?
I think, what's that?
The Big Dance?
Big Dance, yes.
Big Dance.
Company. Big Dance Theater, would use BDT. That technique regularly.
You did?
Yeah. And I think that I put the John Cage stories in my ear, and I just started doing a dance for fun from something from our company. And what really struck me was, without any premonition, without any pre-planning, without any concept in advance, the way that the moves related to the language, this certain gesture seemed to be a perfect resonance with the language, with the words, with the ideas being spoken, that you would think I had put the two together with a conscious intention. But I hadn't. So I thought, holy cow, you know, Cage, you always talked about all the kind of magical repercussions of chance.
Arbitrary.
Putting things together by chance means. This is kind of a very exciting example of what Cage was talking about. So I just kept going and adding more and more and more until it became a full piece. But it's really a piece about chance connections between elements that are put together arbitrarily, or at least not wholly arbitrarily, but with no preconception in mind.
So again, people can go to cageshuffle.com and find out where, or see an example of this.
Well, they can, yeah, they can find, they can see on the calendar and see all the places where it's going to be happening. They can see a video of the piece. They can see the tech writer so that they can bring me to their theater. They can see everything they need to see for me to do their birthday party or bar mitzvah. I'm kidding about the birthday party and bar mitzvah, but I'm not kidding about always looking for new venues in which to perform the piece. Princeton is happening, and then...
Well, that's pretty, you know, a lot of pedigree there, and you said Harvard. I mean, so yeah. Maybe you're by, you know, setting those lofty examples, you're going to intimidate...
Well, I would even stoop to doing it like Oxford and Cambridge. It's going to, you know,
Oxford, Mississippi,
and Cambridge, Massachusetts. Cambridge, Missouri.
Is there a Cambridge, Missouri? I bet there is.
I bet there is.
There probably is.
June, you know, John Cage, one of his sort of... most famous interludes or well known was that he was a professor at Black Mountain College in Asheville, North Carolina. Black Mountain was this kind of storied, mythical place where numerous sort of Buckminster Fuller, John Cage, Bill and Elaine de Kooning, all these kind of remarkable artists of the post-Second World War avant-garde in America all came together, and they're in this context of this completely radically conceptualized university called Black Mountain College, where I don't think there were grades, and I do know that it was also a working farm, so that every student had a job to keep the farm going. But anyway, this June 20th, Black Mountain is now Black Mountain Museum and Arts Center.
Okay.
And I'm going to be performing Cage Shuffle at Black Mountain.
Well, that's exciting, too.
I know.
When is that?
It's great. It's June 20th.
June 20th. Good time of year, too.
Yeah.
To be in the blue smoke.
Wait. We were both thinking of the same. The Blue...
Ridge.
Mountains.
Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yeah.
Blue Ridge.
Yeah. It's. I don't know. I'll know better once I've... Yeah, go on there and come back. I'll let you know.
Yeah. Right on the other side is Tennessee.
Okay.
So if you're, you know, want to make a run for it.
To Nashville. Right.
Well, that's pretty far. But what's the town that's on the, sort of on the east side of Tennessee? It's one of the big, one of the few, there's three cities.
Knoxville?
Knoxville, yeah. Because Memphis is right on the Mississippi on the other side. So.
July, I'm performing it in Italy, in Umbria, at the Spoleto Festival.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame to have to go to a beautiful part of Europe.
It's going to be warm. It'll be hot, though. So.
I think that's actually true.
Yeah.
Very hot in Europe in the summers these days.
So just bring, be prepared
for that. Make sure to bring no clothing.
Right. Can you perform in the nude? Can you perform
I think this piece I could. I think I don't see any reason. Oh, well, let's see.
And by nude,
have
we
to,
mean
the iPhone. Overalls. I would have to strap the iPhone to myself. Oh, but other than that,
well, I think this
I could.
Could
it
be
would
done.
Be really.
It's on shuffle, you know. You don't need to actually touch anything. So you could do this through Bluetooth, too.
That's true.
You could have the actual, you know, media player, the iPhone, or whatever, off stage.
That's true. I've done it with Bluetooth once or twice when I did workshops and students.
But for what the whole thing is about, you say a half hour? Because you do about 25 of these 1 minute.
Yeah.
And they're spread apart by the usual few seconds
thing.
In between.
So I'd call it a 40 to 50 minute performance.
Oh, okay. So, you know, it's possible something could go awry with Bluetooth. You know, I mean, as good as Bluetooth is, it's not hardwired.
Yeah.
You know, which is always more reliable.
Right.
You know, so you're taking a chance for a little blip.
Chance operations. Yeah. In the chance operations.
Yeah. Have you had any problem with that yet in one of your live shows?
Well, I've never done Bluetooth for a live show.
Or even a case where you always check the battery, make sure you get a full battery.
Yeah.
That you're fully charged.
I guess the only thing is if I, the volume of the.
Oh, right.
In-ear device is really important, and that's...
And it doesn't fall out.
...fiddled with me. Yeah. There's a whole other component in terms of the listening, which is when Cage created this piece, as they say, he made 90 stories, and he recorded them. Simultaneously, though, his collaborator, David Tudor, also a composer and famous pianist, David Tudor made a score, a sound score, for the piece in a completely separate studio, unrelated to where Cage was recording Cage Shuffle. Tudor played this score, which had a lot of like very abrasive sound in it, large gaps of silence, and then there'd be like, you know, crazy stuff. And then Cage put those sounds score together with his speaking score. So when you listen to the Cage score, you'll hear him say, like, when I was, you know, 14, I went downtown in Los Angeles, you know, he'll be telling some story, he calls it Los Angeles, and I, and you'll hear this massive sounds in there. So I have to hear that when I have it in my ear.
Oh, I understand.
So
is it?
So that sometimes is challenging.
Yeah, because that's loud.
It's loud and can be excruciating.
And can you remember where they are, those things?
You know, you start after many, many, many performances to sort of unconsciously, instinctually.
An instinctual thing starts to take over, right?
Exactly. It's a little like a dog knowing they're about to be whacked in the head.
Do you abuse a dog?
I'm the dog.
Oh, in this case, that's right.
You're right.
And you're getting the whacking.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So that's the thing I wanted to tell you about.
It's
Do you
great.
Have any questions
great.
About me?
Well, I've been asking, I think.
I think you have.
Yeah. So that's obviously been the central thing going on in your world in the last bunch of
months. Cage Shuffle, teaching, directing,
and where's
performing.
The teaching going on?
While I was up at Harvard performing, I taught there for a term.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm teaching at NYU.
Oh, great.
And the other element is our company, Big Dance, just had a piece that went to the Old Vic in London and then went to Berlin and then went to Cal Performances in Berkeley. And it's touring life's probably completed. It started at BAM, but it was called 17C, like as in 17th century, because it was rooted in the diaries of Samuel Pepys, who wrote a diary for 10 years. Do you know Pepys from 1660?
I remember you telling me about this.
Oh, okay.
I think.
That's certainly possible.
do. I should have listened to our last, you know,
thing. Yeah. Well, that was a few. Thing. That was quite a few years ago. But it's entirely possible that I was on the beginning end of the piece.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we created the piece and performed it and toured it, mm-hmm. and it finally finished at the end of 2018. Yeah. So that's kind of what I've been up to.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, my
I love
pleasure.
Being on the show. I like every few years to have occasion to consider what I've been up to. You know, because
oh,
you
it
have,
does. You can kind of it gives you a platform to summarize. Summarize. I guess that would be the thing. I have to keep checking because you get loud.
Oh, sorry.
It's like it's like the whacking of the dog again. It's except yeah, I'm on the receiving end this time.
No, that's right.
I got the ear.
I'm totally sorry that I did get a little excited and whacked you in the head orally.
Yeah, right. Which is where you're getting whacked.
Yeah.
From
when I do Kate
Tudor.
Shuffle.
Tudor.
John Tudor.
John Tudor. Well, I appreciate it too because I'm getting my, you know, I'm getting schooled to some degree also in on these things. I have some just, you know, living in New York City and exposing myself and, you know, to the arts over the years. You build up a certain amount of knowledge and experience around experimental works and dance and and I have. But, you know, it's interesting, too, because American audiences and European audiences have very different perceptions of these things or you know, ways in. I remember going to being in Paris my first time in 1987.
Uh-huh.
First night, my friend Emma took me to see Merce Cunningham.
Uh-huh.
And he performed, I forget the venue, but he performed, there had to be a few hundred people there.
Uh-huh.
A couple hundred. It was not big. I remember that. And he, you know, he even performed. He was still.
Yes, he
performed
right
up to the
very,
end. Much,
very,
right?
Very late into
his
life.
He was an old man then, in 87. Yeah. And he was still around for at least another 10, 15 years at least.
Yes.
I don't know when he died, but it not that long ago.
No.
Maybe in the last 10 years.
No, you're right.
8 or 9 years.
Right.
So he performed, and at the end, I mean, I just, you know, I couldn't believe that the people went crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy applaud, like screaming.
Yeah. Cage Cunningham, their collaboration was, you know, world famous. And I couldn't agree with you more about the intensity of the appreciation of the two of them in the European context. The way I'm aware of it is when I performed Cage Shuffle in Berlin and Cologne, the audiences were just hinging on every word of John Cage's that I spoke.
It's amazing.
They're just thrilled and fascinated by him. And Cage and Cunningham, again, in terms of pushing the limits of chance connections, the way they work together is Cage would compose a score for a Cunningham dance, but he would never perform the score for the dancers, so that when they first performed the piece, that's the first time the music and the dance would go together. So the dancers would perform the dance as they'd learned it, and the music would occur. But everybody, the dancers, the audience, Cage and Cunningham, all of them were hearing it all together for the first time, as it was happening for the first time.
And the dancers must have been trained just to know how to
absolutely
work with that and
not be pulled off of what they were going to do,
right?
Even if a new sound score
invaded
their head.
Imagine
which,
if it did, and if that was, I mean, they just...
Yeah.
It would be completely sabotaged.
Right.
You know?
And I'm sure there is a real sort of muscular strength required to perform a piece and not be pulled away from it by a new sound score.
Yeah. And we've been, I mean, raised with this idea, right, that music and dance and choreography go together.
Yeah, we dance to the music.
Right, and usually to a beat.
Yes.
I mean, I guess, you know, it's not always the case with avant-garde dance or, you know, experimental types. But even ballet. And
oops.
Oh, that see, sounds now like, you're ringing.
Yep, hold on, folks. Don't go anywhere, listeners.
Oh, that's a wall, a phone that's on a wall.
I know, isn't that something?
Wait, you know that's a sales call or something?
I'm sure it is.
This
I
is
can
a.
I can
this
tell
is
by
no
the ring.
LED screen. Is that true?
Yeah, that's Uncle Fred's ring, if I ever heard it.
Oh, Uncle Fred, yeah, he calls.
You know how he rings.
Sure.
How his ring sounds. Yeah, so that they were a remarkable.
So were the audiences in Europe, were they, could you identify like an age group that the primarily, were they people, older folks, or were they middle-aged? Were they kids?
I would say that
young people married professional, you know, right?
Oh, man, people, you know, were. I would say it was a pretty wide range.
Okay,
you know, it wasn't as though it was a nostalgia trip. You know, people that I remember when John Cage first came to Germany, and that's why I'm here.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't sort of the elders, although there were certainly people like that there. It was a whole range from people in their 20s through to people as old as, say, the performer himself. Me.
I got you. Because it just seems like, you know, where is this education coming from? You know, it's some of that where they know his work, whereas the average American, of course, has no idea.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
I think it has in part to do with the amount of venues, like that
I guess that's true.
German, and I think in Western Europe anyway, and probably as true or more so in the East, most towns have theaters. And
usually our town. Not in Europe.
I'm talking about in Europe.
In Europe.
You know, why it is that the European audience might be more aware
of these
has
guys,
to do with
these folks.
These venues that are so prevalent throughout the whole country.
I wonder if
show a lot of different kind of work as opposed to American regional theaters, which are more regional theater fare.
I also wonder if it's the government, since they do subsidize so much art, you know, that if that doesn't play a piece into why so many people, the average people, in compared to here, where an average theater goer or arts person still might be more, you know, familiar with conventional arts, but not so much in, you know, alternate,
I think so,
or underground or whatever you want to describe it. You know,
yeah,
whereas here
I think
it's really
that,
exceptional. Some
right
population in New York and a few other towns, but not by and large. I don't think it's as common.
I agree, and I think it has a lot to do with government subsidy to arts venues, allowing the curators to bring a greater variety of work, not just that which will absolutely sell out and thus sustain the theater,
the greatest
in which case
hits,
it would be only the most high profile of whatever genre you
that's
want.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, that
right.
definitely
plays a part
in
it. Because we know here, like, dance companies have to do these certain dances every year, or certain, right? They have to do these particular dances in order to keep the subscribership happy, the board happy, bring in, you know, regular ticket buyers, because these are familiar branded pieces that, you know, that people have associations with already.
Yep.
And it's very difficult to bring in new pieces.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So they can slip in a couple here and there.
Right.
But I guess it's a good thing and a bad thing, you know. Certainly you'd be able to really have many more choreographers working, making a living, musicians, people, you know, that are creating this work, new work.
Well, that's why it's very fortunate for those New York dance and theater artists to have a little bit of access to the European venues.
Mm-hmm.
If you can inspire the interest of European presenters, then it's... Well, and that, again, was something that really was championed by and initiated by the Worcester Group, that they were sustained at times by the fact that so many European venues wanted to present their work. And then the next generation of more innovative theater and dance makers were the beneficiaries of the Worcester Group's having blazed that trail to various European venues, and now the next generation of companies that have come alongside of and since the Worcester Group began are now also performing a lot in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a certain portion of the American art makers who are benefiting from being a part of the European system, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I just, it sounds like really challenging. I mean, you've been around a long time, so I'm sure that's just been part of your success, or you've been, in that regard anyway.
Yeah.
You know, of creating those connections and those relationships, you know, but just being around for 26 years is helpful.
Yes. Yeah. We started first going to France. You know, these waves come and go, you know.
Yeah.
For a while, we had a home in France and a few different theaters, and then France started diminishing, and Germany came, and in a little bit of Italy, and, you know, you just move around. Not that we've had the level of touring that certain other companies have, but it's been a significant part of our enterprise.
Any other spots, though, like that, where there's a real love of it, not in, like, Japan or something?
Well, in the case of the Worcester Group, they were just in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine the Japanese folks really,
yep,
really love that. I mean,
Annie and I have
people
performed once Korea. My experience, Korea was more acting in, you know, the films of Bong Joon-ho.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
But we actually went to their theater academy, sort of their version of Juilliard,
mm-hmm.
and we directed a play there. But certain companies have gone beyond just France and Germany. As I say, the Worcester Group's been to Japan and also Belgium, mm-hmm. and Brussels. There's the Kai Theater in Brussels. There's festivals in different places. But offhand, I can't name them. But I would say it's a wider circle than just those countries.
Right. Well, it's been terrific. It's so much fun to talk to you. I mean, I just enjoy hanging out.
Totally, absolutely, me too. And so pleased that
there's no Bong Joon-ho
films. Well, yeah, Bong Joon-ho. There's no Bong Joon-ho movies coming
right now.
Up.
Last time you were over, the latest one was just about coming out too. We talked about that.
Yeah,
Snowpiercer. It was the one on the train.
Yeah, it was. And
that was
before
so
that, it was The Host.
My God.
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
He's a great
filmmaker. I've been
filmmaker.
Following his movies. I've seen them all.
He just is in the process of finishing one in Korea, and then he says, I'll be making another one.
Hollywood.
That you can be in. So I'm excited for that. In the meantime, I just did a small film. There's really good actors in it, though. There's an actress named Kate Lynn
Scheel.
Yeah. Is she? Oh,
yeah.
Has she been on the show?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. So I did a film.
Well, she's done a lot of... She was on House of Cards, for God's sake.
I didn't realize that.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
a wonderful
she,
actor.
She was, I'm sure. She's kind of crossed over into done a couple of... I think it's more television. Because my ex-wife was also on the same... She was on, I think, the same episode. I think they shared a car, in fact. Seriously, I think they shared a car to the studio one morning.
For House of Cards?
No. Yes.
High Maintenance?
No. Not High Maintenance, who, by the way, Ben was also on the show, the creator of High Maintenance, the dealer. He was on the show. He's a friend. I mean, I haven't seen him in a while. I shouldn't call him a friend, but we're friendly. I guess that's a better way. You and I are friends. Yeah. Ben is a nice guy, but he hasn't been back on. That's how we gauge who my friends are. But Caitlin is lovely. She's a very, very nice person, and I really like her. And she's a very talented actor.
She sure is. So I just did a film with her.
Okay.
And the third sort of...
I'm sure I know.
It's mainly a trio the acting.
Who's the director?
The third guy.
Back up.
A visual artist named Brent Green. And the film is called, it's still in the process of being made.
Okay.
So keep an eye out, though, I would say.
Who's the other
within
person
the year.
It? Do you remember?
The other person in it is a musician, and man, he was great. He's got the, he's sort of an indie, I don't know, star? I don't know what the word is. Indie figure in indie music.
Okay.
His band is called Caliphone, and before that he had the band called Red Red Meat. And his name is Tim Rotilli.
Oh, I don't know him.
And so it was Tim and Caitlin Scheel, and myself. And Brent Green, the guy who directed and wrote it, also
He's in it. He acts in it too.
Yeah,
makes sense.
He's in it, and it's called All the Old Bells, and it's, I think, going to be very, very unique and very.
I look forward
good.
To it. Sure. Yeah. Well, we'll definitely. What we can do is when that does start, you know, hitting the. I guess it'll go through the festivals and all that first. He obviously missed this round.
Oh yeah,
this far as the big.
We're still making it.
I understand.
Yeah,
so maybe 2020.
Good.
You know,
I'll come back.
I'm just guessing
and
that it'll be available. You know, they'll start to try to get into the major festivals, which will begin in about a year, right? Because Sundance is happening now. And it seems like a lot of these guys, you know, they want to get it into the big three.
Yep.
And it just
that's
helps.
How I
it helps.
Initially
and it gets to helps get distribution, right?
Yeah.
But it's amazing how Sundance is up here.
Yep.
And everything else is just
and Sundance has been up there forever.
Oh yeah, forever. But I didn't, you know, really realize until the last couple few years like how the Sundance getting it it's like it's all about like a certain trajectory, right? The pedigree. If it's Sundance, it's imprinted on that, it's embossed, and then you get into a major distribution company. You know, it's
yeah,
it maybe an eight now like an A24 or something like that, and a company like that, you know, and then just get a great package deal together. Mm-hmm. You know, you get a lot of. But any if you fall short of that, it's a real, you know, it's a struggle. I mean, I guess South By or Tribeca, those are good, great festivals.
Yeah.
But, and it's very helpful, but it's still, it's a lot. Just getting into Sundance gives you such a big head start. It doesn't mean that all of those will get distribution.
No.
But, you know,
it's
a good number of them do. But amazing how much of a leg up that is. Just getting it into Sundance because it just gives you this unbelievable, you know, head start. Anyway.
Well, I hope that's where...
We'll see.
See it first.
Doesn't mean that a lot of other, you know, still a lot of films do fine and get seen, and that's all. But I'm just was talking in broader terms. And then putting Caitlin Scheel in or Paul Lazar in a film
and
helps a lot.
And us together, can you imagine?
the chemistry.
Jesus.
Is there a romantic?
The viewership.
yeah,
romantic.
Exactly.
No, I'm a creep, and she detests me.
Oh,
so
okay,
it was
it's chemistry.
It's chemistry of a kind.
No. You couldn't play creep.
Oh, well, we'll see. You'll have to see. I was very proud of my creepiness, actually, in this movie.
Oh, in this one? Oh, really?
Yeah, yes.
Oh, that's good.
Yep.
You don't get a lot of opportunities to do comedy, though, do you? Don't you enjoy doing comedy?
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know.
You're a little shy about it.
And what's not?
It's usually you're playing straight regardless. Generally, unless you're slipping on a banana peel,
right.
Or doing lady.
Although,
yeah,
my feelings about Jerry Lewis, man.
Jerry
wow.
Lewis,
genius.
Is that what? Oh, I wasn't
that,
doing.
Oh, no, that was
yeah. Of course, I was.
Thinking.
Yes.
I re-watched The Nutty Professor a while ago.
Right.
And if you want to understand the Trump phenomenon, watch The Nutty Professor.
Well, they're both men child often,
it's,
right?
It's a Jekyll and Hyde story.
Oh, I see. Where's the
and
Jekyll in the case of
he plays this Trump. Kind of goofy, endearing a lady professor,
right.
And then he takes a pill to make himself handsome.
Into the character's name again.
And he transforms into what?
You just saw it. His name. Come on.
Remember the character's name.
Oh, my God. It's famous. But anyway, yeah, so.
And he's in what Jerry Lewis said was, I thought the audience would find the handsome character.
He was doing Dean Martin, you know. Was it supposed to be his
version
homage?
Of Dino.
Yeah, he was doing Dino.
He said, I thought this character, the handsome guy, who's cold-blooded, mm-hmm. would be off-putting. But the uglier and meaner I made him, the more people liked him. And that's where I feel that Jerry Lewis discovered Trump.
Interesting. Buddy Love.
Buddy. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Buddy Love. But I walked by the Trump.
The same amount of syllables. Trump.
I walked by a Trump building today, and I just, you know, like it just brought up some you know,
feelings of love.
I just can't even stand. It's at the point where I just can't even. I was going to ask you originally when I was thinking about what we were going to initial. Also, I knew we were going to talk about Kate Shuffle, but the .com. Check out the website.
Thank you.
But I thought, you know, maybe start by talking about, or going to be watching the State of the Union.
Is that back on?
Well, yeah, sure. That was part of the deal. She's, you know, if they opened the government, then they would re-invite him into doing so. Yes, he's definitely doing that.
Tomorrow night?
I'm not sure if it's tomorrow. I haven't heard. I haven't checked the. It's supposed to be tomorrow night.
Oh, okay.
It was originally supposed to be, so I don't see why it wouldn't be tomorrow night. But,
well,
my gosh.
I know. Without even watching, that the State of the Union is terrific.
It's the best State of the Union.
The best State of the Union ever done.
Ever done.
Right. Well, I think that's all I have time for today.
Okay. It's a good place to end things. This has been lovely. Let's do another one again when, maybe not wait 2 or 3 years, but we can do it when the film is done and it's out there.
Excellent.
We'll, whether it's through a festival or going into theaters or whatever it goes, we'll time it around that.
Great.
See, and you'll be with Kate.
Great. Sounds great.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Please do leave us a star rating and or a little review on any of the podcast apps that you may be listening to the show on so people can find the show. And remember to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and search Film Wax Radio. It'll come right up. I'm looking to try to start promoting that a little bit more. All of our festival coverage is going up there immediately. So I interview somebody and later that day, the episode goes up. Unlike the podcast, sometimes it can be weeks, months, what have you. Or I should say, here's a great example. This episode, I interviewed Paul a couple months ago, at least 3 months ago. I remember it was a freezing cold, snowy day. And so it had to be January or February. And whereas with Kenneth Branagh, I interviewed him on Monday. So, and it's now Thursday. So sometimes it happens fast. Other times it can take a long time till I get a show up. However, the stuff I'm putting on YouTube is immediate, almost in real time. So I can plug and promote things more expeditiously, I guess you could say. So check it out again, YouTube. And then, of course, we're on all sorts of social media, including Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Thank you, everybody. We'll be back in a few days. George Nicholas, who is a very talented filmmaker, producer, director. I had a great time getting to know him, and he came on the show, and that will be up soon. We also have conversations with my buddy Robert Longstreet, who is an actor, and not to mention all of the coverage, again, from Tribeca, Montclair, and Maryland. So there's no shortage of Film Wax Radio for you to listen to. All right, everybody, thank you very much. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. The name of the show, Film Wax Radio. Take care of yourselves, please, please, and the ones you love. Until next time.